The Western Roman Empire, who subjugated the known world, has fallen. In Gaul, the deadly Game of Thrones begins. This is the Quest for Power.
Welcome to the Quest for Power, where we are rating and reviewing all the European monarchs from the collapse of the Western Roman Empire to World War I. I am always your unreliable narrator, Michael, and joining me on this adventure into the second Burgundian kingdom is Roberto.
Howdy, howdy. See, the second one's doing so much better than the first.
It really is. It really is. I'm going to do a little previously, make sure we hit the main points because we are rating some of the people, and then I'm going to ask you if I forget anything. So are you ready?
Previously on Quest for Power.
Princes Gundiac and Kilpric pull the Burgundians from near extinction into becoming a powerhouse in Roman Gaul. Gundiac ties himself to the kingmaker Ricimer by wedding the Roman general's sister, and together the two have a very fruitful marriage and produce princes Gadisel and Gundobad. Gundobad goes on to play with the big boys in Italy, and he becomes the power behind the Western imperial throne. After Gundiac dies, Kilpric is forced to cede land to the legendary Visigothic king Euric in order to secure peace with their neighbors. Also, after Gundiac dies, Gundobad decides he's had enough fun in the Western imperial court and decides to return to his uncle's side, while Kilpric is reigning as sole king of the Burgundians. Did I miss anything?
Nope. I mean, Gundiac was pretty good. We made him legendary. Kilpric?
Yeah,
he was meh.
He was fine. Yeah,
he was there. Yeah.
He didn't die. He didn't get burned. So, you know, good on him.
I mean, despite my protests.
Don't worry, I have a feeling that someone may be set on fire today.
Ooh.
We'll have to see. Anyway, so after their uncle King Kilpric's death around 480, Gadisel and Gundobad succeed as joint kings. I'm actually kind of surprised this is working for them. Like, I haven't heard any conflicts about brotherly kings or anything that has come up before. It's never happened yet.
You know, I'm very happy to hear that, because typically the kings, well, you know, if you're brothers, you're going to fight each other, you're going to kill each other. I mean, if my brother had some land that I wanted, I'd definitely murder him.
Well, I have land and my brother doesn't yet, so, you know, I hope that's not the case.
Oh, you know what? Let's make something happen. For the sake of posterity, jokes. By the way, Michael, don't drink that whiskey right now.
Oh boy, all right. Damn it, it's so good.
He's turning purple. Oh no, purple wedding.
Oh, well, anyway, despite the kingdom not being divided up, it's around this time that we are revealed, we get a peek behind the curtain of how this hall system works. It works as one rule, but different seats of power. I think I talked about this in the later episodes, but it's because of this one that I understood that. Gundobad, who is the eldest, seemed to be the favorite of the past two kings, and he took a residence in the palace at Lyon and had residences at Vienne. Not Venice, it's Vienna. It's a city in France. And then he also received his cousin Clotilda in the aftermath. Not to marry, but she would reside at his court. Basically as a pawn for him.
Yeah, I was about to ask, did he marry her? Because that would, you know, be the case for these nobles. Oh, my cousin! Future marriage material.
Yeah, but... Yeah. I mean, yes, it would, but I don't think it would serve any political purpose, therefore I doubt it. I think it'd be much more advantageous to marry her off than it would be to marry her.
Yeah, I just forgot a bit about Clotilda, if I'm being honest.
That's okay. We'll learn a little bit more about her, so that's good.
When Gundobad marries her. No, I heard what you said earlier. It's fine.
Gadisel, who was the youngest, was given the royal palace at Geneva, and he probably had a little less influence. He received his cousin Krona in his court because of the death of Kilbrick. So the two sisters were split off, possibly.
Well, based off of the title of this episode, I don't think he marries her.
Nah, it doesn't sound like it, does it?
Nope.
Well, speaking of who he marries, at the time of Gedeisel's accession to the throne, his wife and now queen consort Tudelinda enters the story.
Hello, we know Tudelinda.
These two have had at least two good nights of passion, because it is recorded that they had two sons.
Okay.
I don't know if it's passion. It's probably just sex, knowing back then. Who knows?
It wasn't two nights. It was 2 minutes. A minute per each kid. If that, you know.
He's already catching strays. Oh, boy.
I mean, I'll give him a plus. He controls Geneva. I know the name of that city.
Yeah, that is true. That is
it's
true.
It's in Switzerland. Yeah.
That would be correct. Yeah, it's kind of the whole Geneva Convention held in Switzerland.
Geneva Conventions? Never heard of them.
Yeah, they don't apply this time. War crimes are just normal.
If anything, these are a group of Burgundians. They commit the war crimes.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey.
As you probably can guess, we know nothing about her background. She could be a peasant, a noble, a royal. We know nothing. What we do know is that she was a devout Christian who was part of the Theban Legion Warrior Martyrs cult. Do you know who the Theban Warrior Legion Warrior Martyrs are?
No.
Okay, so they're also known as the Martyrs of Ognum. It's an overly simplified version is they were a Christian Roman legion from Egypt sent to Burgundy to quash a revolt against Christian peasants on the orders of Emperor Maximian. They traveled to Burgundy, but they refused to kill their fellow Christians, and as a result, they were decimated. You know what decimated is?
It's when you kill a tenth of an army.
Yeah. My question is, like, you know how it's supposed to be there, they decimate themselves? If they're not willing to kill, like, Christians, how would they be willing to decimate, or did they get another legion in to decimate them?
Typically, if I remember correctly, do not quote me on this. The person next to you kills you just in case you don't do it.
That's what I mean, but if they're going to refuse, like the entire legion refuses to kill Christians on the sole fact that they're Christians, then why would
get
they...
in another army to do it?
Yeah, that's what I'm guessing, but we don't know. We just know they're decimated.
They drank the whiskey you have.
Yes. After their decimation, they went, you gonna kill them now? And they went, no, they refused again. So they were decimated once more. So another tenth cut off out of their force.
So if this was 100 people, they lost 10 people, which brings into 90, which means they lost 9 people. So if they keep just killing each other, they're gonna get to a certain number where they're, you know, you can't kill anybody anymore.
Yes, the third time they refused, the emperor or the general just went to hell with you and put them all to death.
But they did this in the name of God, and now they're holy martyrs because they could not kill fellow Christians for their emperor, but instead they stayed faithful to God Almighty.
That is correct.
In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen.
Unfortunately, modern historians deem this entire story to be completely bullshit.
They don't know what they're talking about.
They obviously say that in much nicer terms, but let's be just the whole story of they came to from Egypt. A Roman legion came from Egypt specifically to Burgundy that had not been formed yet. And, you know, that's where that whole thing happened. It's just a lot of fan fiction going on, as I should say.
Are you calling hagiographies fan fiction? These are saints' lives. No, they're all true. You gotta believe. No, you gotta believe in the faith, man. You gotta have faith.
I'm a confirmed Catholic. Nope.
I'm a confirmed Orthodox.
I'm a confirmed Catholic that refuses to go to Catholic church because I disagree with a lot of things they have to say.
I mean, I do the same thing with my church sometimes. I like the faith. I like the traditions. I don't like what they're saying sometimes.
Yeah, even yeah, I don't know. I question a lot. We could go into that, but like, yeah, I just have a lot of
Tune in
questions.
to Fourth Wall slash Patreon to find out more.
Yeah.
When it comes to the Great Schism, of course.
Back to Tutelinda, she built several churches in Geneva that were consecrated in honor of these saints, with her husband's cousin Corona, who was there at the court with them. And among them is still standing today is Saint Ursus Cathedral in Solothurn, Switzerland. So that's exciting.
Let me look up this place, St. Ursus Cathedral. That's a pretty cathedral. I mean, it was probably rebuilt a few times, but that's lovely.
Yeah, I'm sure all of these are rebuilt, but hey, you know, at least they had the foundations there.
Yes.
Speaking of Corona, let's talk about her for a little bit. Several years after the death of her parents, Corona had enough of court life in Geneva, and she decided to become a nun instead of a possible marriage pawn for her cousin to use.
Oh, blessed be.
She, like her cousin-in-law Tutelinda, was also a member of the Theban Legion Warrior Martyrs cult in Geneva. So I'm guessing, based on that, I will bet you these two like kind of formed a kind of friendship. I would be guessing if they were both part of the same kind of cult area, which would be pretty cool.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome, especially because it gives them, support amongst each other. So they're not just, two ladies sequestered away in court. They're more so able to be part of the church life, do some almsgiving, be kind Christians that help people.
Yeah. Like we said a little bit ago, she had considerable spending power for Corona, and she established many churches around Geneva with Tutelinda. So all those churches we were talking about, that was also with her. So
Oath of the Devotion is looking really good for Tutelinda.
it is. One of the churches that Corona founded is called Saint Victor, and it lasted from the 6th century all the way to the 16th century when it was destroyed by the Reformation.
This is in Geneva.
I'm guessing so. Cause, yeah, I think everything here happened in Geneva.
Okay, yeah. There's no pictures of it online. Oh well.
Yeah, but to give you a comparison, that's 4 times as old as the United States is now that lasted. So that's pretty impressive. And unfortunately, that's all I could find about Corona, a quiet yet substantial life. But I figured it worth noting because we don't get to hear much about women during this time, and she had enough. A little bit about what's going on in the world while the brothers ascend the Burgundian throne. Around 490, the Burgundian kings noticed Odoacer and Theodoric the Great were deadlocked in a tug of war that was absolutely ripping apart Italy. If they thought, the Burgundian kings, that while these two kings are really hyper-fixated on killing each other, I don't think it would hurt to help ourselves to some of the Italian countryside and, see if it really is worth all the killing that's going on. So they invaded Liguria, Italy. They proceeded to rape, pillage their way through the province, grabbing everything that wasn't nailed down, including people that later became hostages.
That sounds messed up.
Yeah. Kind of fruitful, but unfortunately messed up. Unfortunately for them, the war didn't go on that much longer. News came of Theodoric killing Odoacer during a banquet celebrating their peace, and all of Odoacer's faction and family was massacred as a result. So that was another faction taken off the board, that the Burgundians don't need to worry about.
A moment of silence for Odoacer. Moment's over.
The man who has no bones.
Oh,
Now we're getting to my favorite part when we talk about royal politics, and this is marriage alliances, because they're the foundations of very personal, very brutal drama down the road. When families start fighting family, that's all because of the marriage alliances that go on.
of course, they're marrying each other.
Exactly. So now that Theodoric finally murdered his most hated rival, he was able to focus on other things like securing power. So he secured full control over the Italian throne, and then he thought that Adelfleda, who was the sister of the Frankish king in Gaul, legendary king, might I add you, Clovis, would be a great mother to his unborn children. So that secured a powerful alliance between two of our previous legendary kings, Theodoric and Clovis, the Franks and the Ostrogoths. they now have the ability to overpower Gundobad, who, you know, himself was no slouch, as we have talked all the way up in this point. He's pretty solid himself.
Mm-hmm.
And so Theodoric, with his kind of new powers, he sent an ambassador to Gundobad, and Gundobad received this ambassador in 494, and the ambassador asked very, very nicely if the Ostrogoths could please have those 6,000 people back that you stole while our back was turned.
Nope.
And Gundobad goes, oh, of course, we're so sorry that we took them, yeah. Provided that you pay for them, and my son Sigismund, he needs a royal princess for a wife. Can you help me with that?
There we go. He wanted something in return.
So while that negotiation's going on with the Ostrogoths, the Frankish King Clovis heard how intelligent, beautiful, and demure Gundobad's cousin Clotilda was, and he asked for her hand in marriage. In a very short window, the three big factions in the West, being the Ostrogoths, Merovingians, and Burgundians, had completely sealed themselves in a triangle web of marriage alliances.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Someone's going to break it, and I'm guessing it's the goddamn Franks.
Gundobad tied himself to the Ostrogothic kingdom by marrying his son to Theodoric's daughter, Ostrogotho, and tied himself to the Merovingians by marrying off his cousin Clotilda to Clovis. So through that, he's got it all set.
You know, just a moment here. Can we appreciate how these two women are named?
Yeah. Yeah, I know, right? Isn't that awesome?
It's like, oh, but like, what's, oh yeah, Ostrogoths. Oh, so Theodoric, what are you going to name your daughter? Ostrogotha. Very creative, but okay.
I didn't put it in the notes because she isn't what I call a protagonist, but her name was actually based on, I can't remember, the empress over in the Eastern Roman Empire, but it was too similar because she was literally named after her that she got the nickname Ostrogotho, and that stuck.
Oh no. Okay. That sucks to be her. Oh, Ariadne. Haha.
Yep, there we go.
The wife of Emperor Zeno. Hey, I know that guy.
Yeah, yeah. We'll say hi to Zeno in the very, 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 very long future.
Oh, yeah. All the rulers.
Yeah. All the rulers, unfortunately, means all the rulers. Including, you know, TR territory, which, you know, it's okay.
Well, if we look at this ruler, it measures 12 inches. Look at this ruler, it also measures 12 inches. But this one's flexible.
Have an entire episode of that.
And this one just broke. So this one gets burnt at the stake. Add more fuel!
So unlike what I told Scott in our previous Clovis episode, Gundobad was not scared of Clovis and afraid to say no to him. The Franks have this whole story that Gundobad was just shaking in his boots when Clovis asked him to marry Clotilda and that he couldn't say no. When in reality, this was kind of when I was saying, like, yesterday, I'm going to kind of prove how that Gregory's story is kind of bullshit, and that's because of this. Like, right here is another hole in his story. Gundobad needed to be tied to the Franks because the Franks were tied to the Ostrogoths, so he needed that counterbalance, and Clotilda was a great way of doing that.
Hey, Clotilda, just so you know, you're marrying the Franks. I know, they're smelly French, but it's okay.
Yeah. they quite don't have the fascination with white flags yet, so it's okay. They're okay.
Can you hear the people singing the songs of screaming men?
So previously we talked about the marriage to Ostrogotho with Sigismund, and this is the first time that Sigismund shows up in the record along with his mother queen consort Caratine. Caratine delivered a princess for Gundobad, whose name is unfortunately unknown to us. So there we go. There's our token woman that we don't know about.
Okay. So Caratine is essentially the powder I put in my drink to as pre-workout, right?
Yes, exactly.
think that's what it's called. Is it keratin?
Creatine.
Creatine, there we go.
You're thinking creatine, not thinking keratin. I think that's how you pronounce it. It's care, T-E-N-E. Like, I think that's how you would say
keratine. Yeah, keratine.
That's what I think. All right.
Creatine, got it.
Again, guess what? We know nothing about Caratine's background. She could have been a noble, a peasant, or a royal. We do, however, know that she is a Nicene Christian, even though her husband, Gundobad, was Arian. So that's fascinating right there.
Good elf of devotion score right there.
And from the scant sources we have, Gundobad's queen Caratine was seen as an important advisor to Gundobad. Like many Catholic queens around this time, she was well known for helping the poor. She influenced her husband to grant clemency towards prisoners of war. She did all that kind of fun stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you recall, this is supposed to be Godizel's and Tudelinda's episode.
Yeah,
right?
I forgot we were covering them. I thought this is the Gundobad show for a moment.
Yeah, Gundobad holds both the power in the Burgundian court. And even last episode was pretty much all about Gundobad, and we barely talked about his brother, except for mentioning that he existed.
Yeah.
Godizel was getting a little irritated at how much power his brother was wielding, and, you know, he was ranking up that royal power score, and he's like, that's not okay. I need some of that.
Come on, and, bro, time to fight.
So with this in mind, Godizel wrote a letter to the Merovingian King Clovis. In the letter, he promised Clovis territory and tribute in exchange for Clovis betraying Gundobad and attacking him.
Raider! Hey, Clovis. I see you're married to my cousin. Gundobad's a jerk. Could you help me, please? I'll give you land and some other, and I'll be your servant. So, please agree.
Yeah. So all of a sudden, Gundobad was made aware that Clovis just invaded his borders out of the clear blue, and now they're at war.
Dun, dun, dun.
Gundobad, completely unaware of his brother's treachery, wrote a letter to Godizel asking for his assistance against the unwanted visitors in their joint kingdom.
Ha! Brother, help me! I'll be right there. Yes, I gotta finish this match first.
Yes.
I can't pause an online game.
It's a real-time game. I'm sorry. It's not turn-based. I can't just pause it. Around the year of our Lord, 500, Clovis and Gundobad forces slammed against each other near a river by the city of Dijon, France. You would hear sounds of metal in the air, horrific screams of battle, and in the chaos, Gundobad is like, "Where is my brother's aid? He said he would be here. I could really use his help right now. These Franks are a lot tougher than I thought they would be." And then over the horizon, Godizel's banners appeared. Relief turned to horror when Godizel's troops fell upon Gundobad's own forces who were engaged in combat with the Franks, and the result was a complete rout.
Well, you know, sometimes you gotta show them a bit of brotherly love, and if that means taking over your land, even better.
Yeah.
So watch out for your brother, Michael.
I know. Oof. Don't want to give him any advice. Immediately, Gundobad fled to Avignon in the southern part of the Burgundian kingdom. Godizel was quite pleased with himself, and he entered the city of Vienne as a triumphant victor. And now he holds the major power in Burgundy.
Ha, 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 ha. I am the new king.
You know, that's actually incredibly smart what Godizel did here. Mm-hmm. Well, let's just appreciate, like, yes, it's horrible treachery, but what a beautifully well-crafted play. Like, well done. Well done.
Honestly, I'm just imagining the Battle of Helm's Deep, which you know nothing about.
I know that exists and everyone talks about it.
And the Gandalf just comes down, but instead of helping the Rohirrim, he kills the Rohirrim, and that is exactly what I'm seeing.
Instead of Gandalf the White, it'll be Gandalf
the Black. Yeah!
Hey, I can make jokes, and even though I don't know.
I'm still trying to get him to watch it, but he's too stuck in House of the Dragon.
I know, yeah. Clovis, he completed his end of the bargain, so he withdrew back into his own borders and probably sent envoys to Vienne going, "Congratulations on your victory, now pay up."
Hello, sir. We need some money.
A quick note. In Clovis's episode, I told Scott that Clovis besieged Gundobad in Avignon, but then Gundobad, aided by one of Clovis's advisors, worked out a deal with Clovis, who then lifted the siege. Total bullshit. We're striking that from canon. It didn't happen. Gregory of Tours is telling a blatant lie again. It is very clear that Clovis went back into his own kingdom because he's like, I did my part, you know.
Warning, Gregory of Tours is a bold-faced liar with a bad butt.
I hate him so much. After his victory, Gadisel and his queen consort Tutelinda founded the monastery of St. Peter in Lyon. It is suspected that this was a strategic decision to strengthen his alliance with the newly converted Clovis in preparation for the counterattack by Gundobad. Because, you know, Clovis now converted and he's all holier than thou, now that he's a good Catholic or Nicene Christian king.
Is he Nicene?
Yes. Yes. Clotilda converts him.
Good job, Clotilda.
In Avignon, Gundobad begins picking up the pieces of his court when all of a sudden his daughter, who was the unknown princess earlier, she dies of unknown causes.
Womp womp.
A lot of information I just gave you there.
Well, I know what she died of. She died of, here's what she died of. She died from eating some bad cheese.
Yeah, yeah. My thing is, I wonder if Gundobad then blames Gadisel for her death. Like, maybe the move or something, when they were forced out, killed her.
The cheese was rotting, but they had nothing else to eat.
Yeah.
And then Gundobad just goes, God damn you, Gadisel!
Yeah, exactly. And we're made aware of this happened from a letter Caratine and Gundobad received from Bishop St. Avitus of Vienne, who consoled them on the death of their daughter. So Avitus once again coming in clutch.
Yeah, when Avitus actually was writing this letter, his hand was shaking quite a lot from all the creasing. Do you even lift, bro? Lifts that pencil and Bible.
One of the first moves Gundobad made was to secure a friendship with the new Visigothic king Alaric II, who had succeeded his legendary father, Euric, to the kingdom of Toulouse.
Alaric II? Wait a second.
Guess. Beautiful. I'm guessing that Alaric was starting to get quite nervous with, you know, Clovis's growing power, and Clovis enjoyed attacking his neighbors, so he probably wanted, like, a stronger ally in his corner against the Franks that were probably going to be on the horizon.
Wasn't Alaric the end of the Visigoths?
You would be correct.
Yeah, I remember that.
Mm-hmm.
Starts and ends with Alaric.
It does. Of the that part
dynasty,
of the Visigoths.
Yeah. Of that of dynasty, the Balti, yeah.
Of the Balti dynasty, correct. Technically, his son survives, but it was like the kingdom collapsed, so I was like, nope, we're done. We're gonna pick up later with his son. A year after the Great Betrayal, Gundobad paid his brother back. He raised an army and besieged his treacherous brother in Vienne. Clovis aided Gundobad in a half-hearted attempt with some Frankish warriors, but that didn't really do much. I'm guessing he's just like, oh yes, yes, I'm allies with you. Who don't we like? Oh yeah, he's causing trouble. Yeah, you guys go over to Gundobad. I mean,
I can send you men. Here's three.
Yeah. Don't say I didn't help you.
They're all old and decrepit. Well, you know, I'm sending you. It's all I have. You know, got to deal with it.
Yeah, I have my own problems to worry about. You have to take care of yourself first before you can help others.
I can't kill fellow Christians. Wink, wink.
Yeah. Sieges tend to make people very hungry. And it didn't take long for famine to sweep across the city like a tidal wave in Vienne. Gadisel, in an attempt to save himself, you know, food for him and his warriors, he sent all the non-combatants out of the city. Very, very common, at least in early medieval siege warfare. I think even towards, like, middle ages, it's still common. Because, you know, the name in the game in sieges is resource management, get rid of the mouths, you can last a lot longer.
But they're potential food sources in the future.
Hmm. that is true. But if they're starving to death, the chances are not much meat's going to be on there.
Well, you can eat the liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
Oh, there you go. That is true.
Hannibal Lecter for the win.
All of a sudden, even though the gates were closed, a bunch of Gundobad's troops appear in the city out of nowhere.
Hey, where'd you come from?
Gedeisel knew he was fucked. So he ran to safe zone, if you're playing Capture the Flag, which was an Aryan church.
Is it safe?
He's claiming sanctuary.
Are you sure?
Come on.
Are you sure about that?
Nobody ever violates sanctuary. It's the sanctity of the god and church and all of that. Nobody ever would violate that.
Are you sure about
that? It turns out that one of the exiled citizens of Vienna wanted their home back, and they didn't really care for Gedeisel, so they informed Gundobad how to infiltrate the city via an aqueduct. So,
well,
sending people out might not always work in your favor.
Should have eaten them.
Yeah, wouldn't have betrayed you.
Looks like a meat's on the menu, boys.
Fierce fighting broke out in the streets. Soon the city streets ran red with blood, and the walls echoed with the sounds of weapons meeting and men dying. Eventually, Gundobad's forces killed or captured the defenders of the city and completely sacked it. The victor led his men into the church where Gedeisel was cowering next to the altar with a bishop defending him. An Aryan bishop, I should say, defending him. Gundobad was in no mood to deliver mercy. Blood sprayed across the altar when the holy man and Gedeisel were put to the sword.
Well, that's something. You're dying for Christ.
Yeah. Gedeisel's lifeless body did nothing to quench Gundobad's thirst for vengeance. He massacred his brother's entire family, courtiers, advisors. Anyone who remotely said something nice about Gedeisel was hunted down and murdered in cold blood.
Anyone who sold you Brie, slash down.
Yeah, so among the slain were Gedeisel's queen Tutelinda and their innocent, unnamed, unknown amount of children. But they had children, apparently. Tutelinda was thrown into the Rhone River, and their eldest son was beheaded and thrown into a well. I'm guessing, remember when we were talking about Gregory and the bullshit story about the well? I'm guessing this is where he got his inspiration from.
Okay.
Because it's like, well, he did it earlier, so I can say that he did it before that even, too. It would, you know, be believable.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's the point of throwing them into a well if you cut their head off?
I agree. It's got to be some symbolism or something.
You're just making the well water dirty.
I was going to say, because you're capturing that. I never understood that, because you're capturing that city. Now that water's going to be for you. Why would you do that?
I don't know. Good, the bad. Okay. It's pretty bad.
Yes. Only two granddaughters of Gedeisel and Tutelinda were spared, and this is most likely because they were way too young that even Gundobad was like, I don't wanna kill that. No.
You know,
that's a line too far for even him.
They're children. Maybe I shouldn't.
Yeah. Yeah, one of them is to believe Gunteka, who married the Frankish king Clovis's son Clodomer and had two children with him.
Hmm.
This is also the same woman who will be later married to Clotaire, who kills her children. Isn't history delightfully fucked up?
If you could see the reactions I just had.
Yeah.
Stepfather of the Year Award.
Yeah, not great. Well, that ends the life and reign of Tutelinda the Pious of House Burgundy, the first of her name, queen consort of the Burgundians, and the life and reign of Gedeisel of House Burgundy, the first of his name, traitorous bastard, king of the Burgundians.
What,
are you ready?
Did they die?
That's a good question. We'll have to figure that out, won't we?
Oh, darn, you're making me guess. Okay.
You got too good. Are you ready to rate the unfortunate couple?
Yes. Royal power.
How long was Gedeisel's reign?
20 years?
Pretty damn close. Reigned from 480 to about 501, so 21 years.
Okay. I'm guessing it's the same for Tordelinda?
I did not. I put, there's, she, I'm not, we don't, aren't given a marriage date, so I'm just going to say that's Gadisel's reign, and that's like, because it doesn't give, you know, it just gives
they
us.
They were married, you know.
Yeah,
fine.
They were married. So start with Tudalinda for royal power. She had nothing. She's got
zero.
Nothing of political influence. So
zero. Yeah.
For Gadisel, his move to secure more power was very bold. And if it would have worked out for him in the end, it would have been highly praised.
But it didn't.
But it didn't work for him in the end. Clovis kind of left him all alone to be smashed by his brother. I'm going to give... I love it.
Oh my gosh.
Imagine that how you will. What are you thinking, Roberto?
I'm thinking a two.
A two?
I like the fact that he had that, hey, I'm here to save you, brother. Okay, cool. Fight those guys. Wait, why are you coming to me? Oh god, oh no! And then, I'm the new king now. Oh wait, my brother's back. Clovis? Yeah, here's three men. Oh, shit.
I was gonna give him one, a token one for that, but you're right, that is actually pretty good.
It's like, it's
I'm gonna give
good
him
strategy.
A... I like strategy, even if it doesn't work out for you, now that I think about it. So, I'm gonna go with a three, because, yeah.
Okay.
He didn't work for him, but I love the effort. Solid.
Yeah, I think it's a good two. And then, so it's a two for me and a three for you. So a zero for Tordelinda and a five for Gadisel. Infamy.
Let's start again with Tordelinda. Got nothing. She got unlucky based on who her husband was.
Yeah, zero.
Zero.
Zero for Tordelinda.
Gadisel. He had a very well thought out plot on betraying his brother and executed it. To put it mildly, he committed high treason. During his defensive siege, he threw the commoners out of their home so he could defend himself and his supporters.
I'm going to give him a five.
High treason is a bare minimum six for me.
Like... I mean, it's like the one thing he did. And I already gave him points for the strategy. So the fact that he went behind his brother's back for me is like, okay, you guys were supposed to be ruling together, but you got mad because he was the more popular kid on the block. Okay, so you took his ally from him. That's a five.
Yeah.
If you were successful, yeah. I'd give him like a seven or eight.
Yeah, no, if the success would be more based on, probably would go into legacy and royal power. You get even more for royal power. But again, high treason is... it's up there in terms of infamy of what you can do.
Alrighty. So that's an 11 for infamy. And this is our first infamy score in season 5.
Are you serious? Wow.
Everyone else has zeros.
That's true.
Okay. Oath of Devotion.
Tudalinda. She was recorded as a very devout member of a very specific Christian cult. So we knew that she was at least pretty devoted to the faith if she was already devoted to like a cult. She built several churches with her husband and her husband's cousin Krona.
Six. I think it's a solid six.
I'm gonna go five.
I mean, my reasoning for a six is that she's the one who joined the cult. She's the one who did all of this, and then it was supported by her husband's cousin, and then she gave money to it. So she did this willingly. She's known as the pious. Or is that something you gave her?
That's something I gave her.
Okay. Anyways, I like people who build churches, and some of these churches are still around, even if they've been changed over the years.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So that's an 11 for Oath of Devotion for Tordelinda. Oathkeeper. All right.
Gadisel. He got an Arian bishop killed defending him. He also helped his wife create a Nicene Christian establishments. There's zero record of him creating Arian churches. I will give him the record of the benefit of the doubt that, you know, the monks who were recording this stuff were Nicene Christian sources, but that still means we got no record of it. And zero. He did, yeah, zero.
That's a zero for Gundagaisel. Oathbreaker. Bardic Inspiration.
So for both of them, I have to give points out for living under a brutal siege. Those are always pretty harrowing times and are good, you know, rife for tragic poetry. And then in addition for Tutelinda, her death of being thrown in the Rhone River should earn her some points. That's a horrific way to die.
Okay, so I'm going to think of these as a pair. So they're going to get an amalgamated score.
Oh, okay. You're gonna think of him. Let me go with Gedaisel then. Gedaisel's death was, he was slain at the altar after the bishop was killed protecting him. You can visualize this, you know, like he's holding the altar for dear life. And, you know, he, as he is stabbed, blood is seeping on the altar with his body. You know, it's just beautifully tragic, horrific, very good for inspiration.
And like the scene as I'm imagining it is, you see Gundabad himself coming up into the church, his men behind him, you know, pushing, you know, his troops pushing away any of the priests that are in there, any of the deacons, and Gundabad comes up himself, the priest comes up forward, hands up in the air, you know, a cross in front of him, saying, no, this is a place of sanctuary, this is a church. And Gundabad just slices him down. You see it, it's off screen, so you don't see him actually do it, but you see the blood, you see the bishop's body collapse and blood pulling up. Scene goes back to Gundabad. He's approaching Gundagaisel. Gundagaisel's, you know, on the ground, you know, crawling backwards. It's like, brother, no, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And then you see Gundabad raise his sword, slash, you know, slash down, and then you see the blood spraying on the altar. Roll credits.
Perfect. Beautiful. Love it. Great scene. 10 so out of 10.
So for me, that's going to be a 6 for Gundagaisel. Because the whole thing where you could, I'm seeing this as a movie right now. I saw this whole thing as a movie where you have, you know, the jealous brother, Gundagaisel, who you see Gundabad, you know, being this awesome kid, you know, he's growing up, he's getting all the good stuff in life, but Gundagaisel just off in the background, just, you know, in his brother's shadow. He has a lesser, you know, city. And then he's like, you know, finally I have enough. He, you know, messages Clovis and he's like, hey, let's make something work. And he does make it work. You get that whole scene with, you know, him coming off, you know, up the hill, banners in hand, and then charging straight towards his brother instead of Clovis. Then, you get him, you know, reigning in Lyon. Then you get Gundabad coming in, besieging the city. You basically have him defending the wall, sending the people out, but in the meantime you also record him, you know, having an argument with this one guy. You know, it doesn't have to be the exact frame for frame. This guy just wanted to be back in for his house. You can just get him into yes. it could be one of his older officers, like, you know, a la 300 style, where you have this guy who wants to fight but doesn't, you know, Gundagaisel is just like, no, you're too old. And he just goes and just tells Gundabad everything about how to get into the city. Gundabad, you see Gundabad marching in, slashing people down. You know, Gundagaisel runs into the church and you get that ending scene I gave him. That's a 6 for me.
Love it.
Actually, I think I just worked myself up to an 8.
I was going to say, you can do 6. I'm doing 8 after what you said. I didn't write that much, but after that beautifully rendition, obviously it was very inspirational. I'm going to give him an 8. Are you giving the same to both? Because it seemed like you were.
No.
Okay.
I was just thinking of them together, but then like I changed my mind as I kept telling the story. So yeah, that's an 8 for me. So that's a 16 for Gundagaisel. And then for Tutelinda, she's a background character in this story, unfortunately.
Yes.
Like you get some cool scenes of her, you know, dealing, you know, doing, being the great queen, because you have this jealous, you know, her jealous husband who doesn't like his brother, but then you have the opposite where you have the sweet woman who's, you know, going out to churches, building, yes, you know, putting money to build them.
Yep.
And then she, you know, works with, you know, her husband's cousin. You know, they become good friends. You know, she's a nun now. And then, you know, you see you're just being good and kindly. So it kind of balances Gundagaisel. But then, you know, you see her basically helping people during the siege. She's there to be a support. Everyone loves her. But then, you know, Gundabad comes in. And then this is the scene before, you know, before you show Gundagaisel get killed. you show Tordelinda's death along with her sons as, you know, Gundobad's, like, not his, his second in command is doing this instead. And basically slashing down her children, throwing her into the river.
How are they throwing her into the river? Are they going to, like, a bridge? Or are they, like, what's the, how are they going to kill her by that?
So I'm imagining she just runs into a house as she's trying to escape. And they charge in after her. And then they literally, the house is, it just happens to be next to the river. And and then they just, you know, they come up to her. They, you know, they stab her through the stomach. Then toss her out the window. And you see the splash and then the blood just kind of seeping up in bubbles, and that's it.
Oof, I love it. Okay, what are you going to give for that one?
A 5.
I'm giving a 6. I really enjoyed that rendition.
So that's a 16.
I am loving this category now. This is going to be really fun. I'm not going to have to write much for this one.
I like making movie scenes.
I love it. Oh my god, this is perfect.
So that's a 16 for Gota Geisel, and that's an 11 for Tordelinda. Legacy.
Alright, so for both of them, all of, in regards of their family, all of their children and supporters were killed with them. I'm willing to give both points for both for creating the churches that are still around today. They both had a hand in it. Pretty impressive stuff.
1.
On that end. What?
Oh, you're not done yet. Okay.
No, that's it. Nothing individually. That's all I got.
1 for both.
Yeah.
So that's a 2 for Tordelinda and Gota Geisel. Alrighty. So the scores are up. I'm going to do Tordelinda first. With an 11 in Oath of Devotion, an 11 in Bardic Inspiration, and a 2 in Legacy, a 0 for Power and Infamy, that gives Tordelinda a 24.
Pretty respectable.
That puts her in third place.
That's wild.
All because of her Bardic Inspiration and Oath of Devotion.
It's wild.
So let's give her her final ruling before we go to her husband.
Alrighty. So is Tordelinda exceptional enough to be crowned as a legendary queen consort? Is she just good enough to, we'll give her a retirement in a lesser noble, probably in a nunnery if she desires, or so incompetent that she is burned at the stake?
Lesser noble.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't, I was, you know, she was fun, but just because I made her so. So, yeah, lesser noble.
Perfect.
So, lesser noble for you, Tordelinda.
Yes.
Now for Gota Geisel. It's a 5 for Royal Power, an 11 for Infamy, a 0 for Oath of Devotion, a 16 for Bardic Inspiration, and a 2 for Legacy, giving Gota Geisel a total of 34 points, and our top scorer now.
Oh my goodness. All right, before I even say the other thing, I'm changing my mind entirely on what I thought I was going to do when I wrote this script. This is why I love recording. It just, oh, all righty. Well, speaking of which, is our top scorer good enough to be crowned as a legendary king, retire as a lesser noble, or is our top scorer so incompetent that we burn him at the stake?
Honestly, burn him at the stake.
I was thinking that when I was writing this.
Okay, so let me make my case.
You did too good of a job in Bardic Inspiration of getting the frustration. Like, you can feel him. Like, you can feel his frustrations of being, you know, always put down upon. He's the second son of the kingdom. And then he does something, and it's really well, and he does a really good job. And of course, it's horrific. It's awful. And then it, you know, bites him in the ass on the way out. But he has a wonderful death scene then afterward.
So let me state my case. I would love to make him a lesser noble, but here's why. And, you know, the whole story, he's a great story. I'm just going to say that. However, in regard to the Kingdom of Burgundy, he, as you mentioned, he committed high treason. He couldn't hold on. He couldn't defeat his brother entirely. he couldn't hold on to an ally that he made because Clovis? Yeah. Clovis just wanted, you know, he promised him land and money, and then it was like, all right, that's it. So he did fun things. I'll admit that. But at the end of the day, he couldn't do anything that cemented his position. It was just all one-offs, and because of those one-offs, Gundabad was able to come back and take over, because he couldn't even help, you know, cement an alliance with the Merovingian king. He literally just was like, all right, send me some men. He's like, all right, here's three people. And if he was able to, make it so he had a good ally, I would have said Nestor Noble, but because his ally didn't come to help him, because he couldn't, you know, entirely defeat Gundabad in a way that Gundabad would not return, burn at the stake.
I agree. You convinced me.
Finally.
Enjoy the sound effect.
So our top scorer has been burnt at the stake.
That is wild. I love it. Oh god, I love this show. I mean, that is awesome.
The only difference between him and Gundiak, which is his father, is literally by 1 point. Because Gundiak has a 33, and he's a legendary monarch, and we have a 34, who's burnt at the stake.
Oh my god, that is beautiful. That is wonderful.
All because... welcome to Quest for Power, where the points don't matter, and all that matters is the final ruling.
Yes, I love it. Oh, that is beautiful. They're more like guidelines.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I will pass someone, if someone's like, can you tell me about a Burgundian king, which I don't know anybody will. I'm like, here's a really cool death scene. Go to Geisel. You know, his whole family gets killed. Like, because he commits high treason. And here's how it happens. And this is fun for me. Which sounds demented as fuck, but this is fun for me. As you can tell.
when I talk to people about the podcast, and I'm like, yes, I really love it when it gets really dark and really horrible and like things that I'd never want to have happen in reality, because I don't know. That's interesting to me.
We're so far removed from reality.
Yeah. As long as it happens before World War I, I want the dark crap. After World War I, we're good.
Would it be World War I or when Turkey's Ottoman Empire finally falls in 1922?
Probably that. Okay. I say World War I, but we'll...
We'll figure it out.
We break the rules a lot in this.
So...
That is what we do at Quest for Power, is we break all the norms.
Alrighty, so what's next?
Alrighty, so that'll bring us to the end of Tutelinda and go to Gadizel. Do you think we did properly by letting her retire as a lesser noble and burn Gadizel at the stake, even though he is our top scorer?
I did all the work on to make his story better, apparently.
You did. I was so ready to burn him before this even started, and then you convinced me to not, and then you convinced me to burn him again. It's fantastic.
The power of persuasion.
Oh, great stuff. To be fair, you can get...
I was going to give him a low bardic inspiration score, then I was like, wait, let me talk more about how I think his death scene, and I'm like, wait a second. This sounds like a good story.
Obviously, it's good. Yeah, it's inspiration. Doesn't even have to happen that way. It's the bardic inspiration. That's the point of it.
I mean, if it wasn't for his bardic inspiration, he'd be like...
Oh, yeah, correct.
On the low end.
You can catch us at Messenger on Facebook and Instagram at Quest for Power, or email us at questforpowerpod@gmail.com. This podcast is researched and scripted by me, Michael, and edited by Roberto. If you would like to support the show, you can do so for the low price of free by giving us a 5-star review on podchaser.com/questforpower. It takes a lot of resources to research and produce these episodes, but we love doing it. If you would like to support the show, you can do so by becoming a member of our royal court at thequestforpower.com. to come chat with us on Discord and gain exclusive to extra episodes, like our first members episodes, which will be The Curse of Power. We will rate and review the kings and queens of Egypt. If that's not your thing, no big deal. Giving us a 5-star review on your podcatcher of choice or just telling someone about this podcast goes a long way. We appreciate your support. If that's not your thing, just telling someone about this podcast goes a very long way and is very appreciated. We will read every 5-star review on Podchaser, even if it is one of the co-hosts.
Called out. I'm sorry. I wasn't a co-host yet.
That was funny. Unless you made another account, I'm pretty sure this isn't you. Thank you to KD Quick, who said, quote, a very enjoyable podcast recommended to both history geeks and non-specific geeks with a slight bend towards D&D and a little of Game of Thrones. This makes both the subjects and the hosts more relatable and very funny. Good history, excellent format. Keep up the work. Good work, guys. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Awesome. I mean, that was for you and Scott, but yeah, you guys rock. Yeah.
we had a good time. Yeah. Next episode, we are finally getting to the end of King Gundobad and his Queen Caratine's epic story.
And so, with Gundobad and is taking some creatine and getting pumped.
Yes.
I was imagining him as like this built up really big guy, and then
yeah, with the shaker, the shake bottle.
Yeah, literally, it just says creatine and it just has a crown on it. Yes. He's just a bodybuilder, bro. Like, I have muscles like Ani.
And his wife, whose name is Caratine, she's like, oh, would you just stop?
No, it's just the creatine bottle with a crown on top.
Oh, that's the wife?
Yeah. Yes, the wife, yeah.
Oh, savage. With that, the king and queen are dead.
Long live the king and queen.
All the Game of Thrones jokes today.
This is literally going to be at the end of the episode.